grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode 286, the Dudes and Beer podcast. I'm Chris Jordan, your host. Our guest tonight, the amazing, the awesome Richard B. Spence, professor at Idaho State University, amazing author. I have thoroughly enjoyed his book, Secret Agent 666, Aleister Crowley, British Intelligence, and the Occult. Fantastic read. We need to have him on sometime to talk about his actual class that he taught for like 30 years on the history of espionage, especially coming up against the election, things like that. That's always a time to kind of remind people that there has been wild, wild things that have happened in the world of espionage whenever it comes to elections, that kind of stuff. So we definitely need to have him on up around election time to talk about that. Tonight, we will be talking about the Knights Templar. One of the great, great things that I came across that introduced me to the work of Richard B. Spence was the Great Courses series on Amazon Prime. It's fantastic. It's great. I absolutely loved it. I'm in the middle right now of Quantum Mechanics still. That one's thick and chunky, but it's great. All these courses taught by professors, professionals, authors, researchers. It's like little mini lecture series on stuff. And Richard Spence taught a course on not only espionage, but on secret societies for many, many years. And here is the actual intro for that right now. Oh, well, clip malfunction. Sorry about that, folks. Had a computer update just before the show started, so sorry about that. Richard B. will be coming in cold this evening. Richard, welcome back to the technical difficulties. How are you doing this evening?
Well, I'm great to be on, and hopefully I won't become one of those difficulties, but yeah.
No.
Well, you know, just before the show began, we were talking about make a plan and something will come along and screw that up. So that's already happened.
That's right.
So we've gotten all of that out of the way, hopefully.
Absolutely. So. That's just it. It is already way out of the way. No problems now. Show goes on. So how has the world of retirement been for you? When we last spoke to you, the world of COVID, I guess, had just really begun. And things for you had really kind of come to a culmination after years of work at the university and teaching, things like that. Tell us how things have been on your retirement front. How have you been enjoying that?
Yes, I have. You know, the plan wasn't what it, you know, again, make a plan and then reality will come along and hit you in the head or change it in some way. So, yeah, I was pretty much set on retiring. You know, the university was looking to cut some costs and offered those of us who were, you know, old enough and dispendable to, expendable to a kind of, I won't call it a, you know, a kind of bronze handshake or whatever it was. But, yeah, they sort of offered us a deal that, you know, you couldn't really refuse, and that made the decision to do that. So, you know, one of the things, you know, I'd say that's kind of interesting about retirement that I'm getting used to is that I can just pretty much do what I want and not do what I don't want. And that's one of those things that's, you know, I don't think there's nothing terribly profound about it. It's kind of liberating in a way to think that you can do that, but then you actually have to think of something to fill up that time. So, yeah, I've got projects lined up. My wife has other projects lined up for me in terms of home improvement projects.
Oh, always.
Which I've been getting down to. You know, a lot of things have been taken care of, but yeah, no, it's great. I recommend it highly.
Good. Yeah. Well, and I mean, any time that somebody can finally get to the point of culmination in their career that they can step back and kind of reassess their place in their field and what they're doing, I think the fact that you are continuing your work, continuing your research beyond the realm of straight teaching in a classroom like you have for 30 years is fantastic. And the fact that you're going to continue writing, the fact that you're going to continue producing great things like the Secret Society series on great courses.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to doing more work with them. I can't say that much about it, I don't think, but we're in the in the process of doing another course now. It doesn't deal with secret societies, deals with let's say it's in the realm of true crime, of the homicidal nature. And it combines everything from, you know, Charles Manson to the assassination of Leon Trotsky. There you go. How do those fit together? Well, you'd have to find out.
But yeah, stay tuned.
So hopefully that will, you know, a knock wood, that should be out sometime next year, I would hope, if all things go according to plan.
And that's actually really short order, looking at things in a production light. So that's fantastic to hear that you already have new things coming out, new things on the horizon, and you have just started this journey for yourself. So congratulations and kudos to you on that.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, let's start diving in a little bit. I had some articles, things like that, that I was going to show as typical, but with the computer update, we aren't going to have those this evening. It's just going to be me and you, Mr. Spence. So let's kind of start diving into the world of the Knights Templar and demystifying this a little bit for our audience, because, of course, the Knights Templar are really root seed of so many of these secret societies that we hear about, things like the Masons that we talked about last time, the Hellfire Club, things like that, even the Rosicrucians that we'll get into a little bit later. But let's start laying the framework real quick for our audience factually of what the Knights Templar were, how they got started, and what really brought them to the acclaim that they were known for at the time.
Well, you know, the Templars were fairly famous in their day, you know, as famous as you could be, say, in the 12th century, without media promotion. And if anything, they've probably become a bigger deal since. And, you know, in a way, when somebody says something about the Knights, talk about the Knights Templar, the first thing that comes to mind is that, well, in a way, my first reaction is that, I don't know, hasn't enough about them been said already? I mean, they're probably one of the most overworked tropes of the secret society or conspiracy realm. And, you know, I bring that up to one of my guilty pleasures when it's on is watching Curse of Oak Island.
Oh, God, yes.
History. It's one of those shows that I admit that I kind of set and, you know, to myself, you know, talk back to in some ways. You know, in some ways I admire what the guys are doing. There obviously was something kind of out of the ordinary going on at Oak Island.
Sure.
Whether it had anything whatsoever to do with the Templars, though, I don't know, and I haven't seen anything that would really suggest that. But it's kind of interesting that they bring that up every time they can. And, you know, it's on the production end that's being done, because, you know, you find something, some sort of bauble, you know, you find a ring and that, well, could this, you know, if this is medieval, then somehow it's some kind of connection to the Knights Templar.
Sure.
And that's because the producers know that the audience out there will kind of recognize that name and it connects it to something which is historical, but above all, mysterious.
Yes.
And that's the thing that I found, you know, one of the things I've concluded, no great leap here, but is that, you know, as human beings, we don't like vacuums. We don't like, we're never terribly satisfied with the answer, even though it may be the right one, that I don't know. And when we're presented with a vacuum, when we're presented with something where there isn't a kind of clear narrative or there isn't a whole story there, well, basically, we set about making one up. We're constantly trying to fill that in. And that, in a sense, I think is what's contributed to much of the kind of Templar mythos that's developed by the 20th or even by the 21st century. It just goes on, is that it's this constant attempt to try to fill in the blanks, to try to explain something about the Templars. But that doesn't mean that there aren't legitimate questions. It just means that there aren't really the kind of clear, satisfying answers that you would necessarily want to have.
Sure.
Main thing, you know, what are you going to start with in terms of facts? Well, the Knights Templar definitely existed. They are not the figment of anyone's imagination. And in their day, they were kind of a big deal. But maybe one way to begin is that, you know, they go back, really, the basic year that they would come into being, I think, is around 1118 in what was then, you know, the Holy Land. The Crusades are underway. They are born in the midst of the Crusades. They die or cease to exist shortly after the Crusades have ended. So their whole sort of lifespan is connected with that. And that's essentially because they were a monastic order of holy warriors. They were a militant monastic order, at least the core of the organization was. They disappear from history in 1314. And, you know, often they don't disappear all at once. So actually the dissolution of the Templar order takes place between the time of the initial arrests and accusations, and then finally the burning at the stake of their last Grand Master, Jacques Dumoulin, there's 7 years that take place. Things happen kind of slowly in the Middle Ages, but it was a process rather than this kind of sudden bolt from the blue that might appear. So the Templars really existed. They did become something of a big deal. They became a monastic order. They were recognized by the Pope. In fact, they even got a kind of special deal. I think it was in 1129, they got official recognition from the Pope. And then they would subsequently actually get I think it was Pope Innocent II, issued a decree called the Omne Datum Optimum, which made them answerable to the Pope alone.
Yeah.
So there was no other sort of, so they weren't just your kind of run-of-the-mill monastic order, but again, they're a warrior monastic order, and they're one that had a special relationship with the Pope himself. What they began as is the Knights of the Temple. They get the name Knights of the Temple because they sort of set up a headquarters in Jerusalem, which, maybe I need to kind of backtrack here and give a little, you know, pedantic history. Crusades began around 1099. I think they began around the year 1100. That was the first crusade. Army of Western European knights recruited from across Christendom marched into the Middle East and eventually, after a great many difficulties, stormed, sacked, and took Jerusalem. Their purpose in this, basically, was to restore the safety of Christian pilgrimage from Christian Europe to Jerusalem. That's actually something that, even though Jerusalem had been under Muslim rule for centuries, most of the Muslim, the Arab leaders before then, as long as there was a fairly strong Arab empire, had allowed pilgrimage to take place because, hey, they could tax it. It was good for business, you know, tourists. That had sort of come down as the Arab Empire disintegrated and you had Turkish invasions and there was chaos going on. And so the Crusaders sort of become part of this chaos in an effort to stem the chaos, if that makes any sense. But the whole idea of securing the pilgrimage route was essential to the whole crusade itself. So Jerusalem was taken, a thing called the Kingdom of Jerusalem was set up, and there were various other sort of associated crusader states all over the eastern Mediterranean. And those will last about 200 years. So a group of wealthy knights, and this is one of the things, that the Templars from the beginning tended to attract rich guys. Now, people from the nobility, people who already had land and money and some significance. They weren't an organization of nobodies. So initially, 9 men met together, and they had sort of set up as the headquarters of themselves around the old Temple Mount in Jerusalem, which was the capital of this Crusader state, and they secured recognition from the King of Jerusalem, the Christian Lord who had made himself the head of this small state. And the 9 of them were going to form and seek recognition as a monastic order specifically to protect pilgrims. That was the whole idea behind this, is that we're going to take up the use of weapons. We're basically going to become holy warriors, kind of warrior monks, with the initial idea of protecting pilgrims going to and from Jerusalem. And then things kind of expanded from there. They became popular, apparently became pretty fashionable to be a Templar. They recruited people from some of the most important families in France, Germany, elsewhere, all across Europe. In fact, the whole of Christian, at least of Roman Catholic Europe, not so much in the Orthodox areas. And then the organization grew. It took off. And it grew from 9 men to hundreds, and eventually, within about a century, it had increased to a very large organization of about 15 to 20,000 people. Now, here's where we got to look at things, we kind of zoom in and look at things a little bit in detail. Because when I say that at its peak, the Knights Templar organization, the Knights Templar Incorporated, had 15 to 20,000 members, I don't mean that there were 15 to 20,000 knights, you know, galloping around in white robes with red crosses on them. No. The knights, per se, that is the actual monastic chivalric order, the guys that took the oath of celibacy, you know, the whole monastic 9 yards of celibacy and poverty, they were only about 10% of that 15 to 20,000. So let's say that, you know, at its peak, maybe you had 2,000 knights brothers, as they were called. Now, they're the knights per se. They're the kind of elite of the order. Everything else revolves around them. But they're only about 10% of it. The rest of this corporate structure was composed of, well, below the knights brothers were the sergeant brothers. Okay, so the sergeant brothers were actually more numerous than the knights. They would fight. They could be soldiers as well, although a lot of them were actually involved in handling the business of the order. What was the business? Well, we'll come back to that. But there was a business. So the sergeant brothers were generally not noblemen. The knights were almost all noblemen. The sergeant brothers tended to be commoners. One of the differences is that instead of wearing, you know, white cloaks, they had black ones. Okay, that was the way to distinguish them. So you almost never see them portrayed in films. It's always these guys, you know, in the white robes or coverings that are, you know, charging across the field. But there probably would have been fellows in black robes as well. But the sergeant brothers handled most of the business end of these things. They didn't take full monastic vows. They took sort of limited monastic vows.
Yeah, they would almost be the equivalent of like a lay diaconate. Along those lines.
Yeah, they managed the state. Some of them were things like notaries, for instance. Apparently, if you needed a notary, well, you know, a knight didn't do that. You had a sergeant brother who would do it. Then you had the next group that was connected, again, probably larger than the knights themselves, were the associate brothers or the confrères. And the confrères were, again, basically noblemen, you know, regular, probably someone who was already a knight in Europe, who wanted to play Templar for a while. So these were people who kind of, you know, if you took the whole oath, you entered a monastic order, and that was technically for life. And there were a number of restrictions. If you wanted to play Templar for a while, then you signed on as a confrère, an associate brother, and you could fight along with them in battle. You could take part in other activities within it, but you're only there for a while. So people were constantly coming and going. And then there was yet another group sort of still in the military end, which were the squires, which were, again, were commoners that served the knights and others, and also basically functioned as valets, grooms, and cooks, among other things, the sort of lower level of workers. And that's really what most of that 15,000 to 20,000 people were. Remember, only about, you know, if you say, simplify it, say 20,000, 2,000 are monastic knights, and the rest are all of these people who are coming and going, or the sergeant brothers, or this whole variety of workers within this corporation, one group of which were the Mason brothers. So the Templars had their own sort of cadre of Masons, you know, very important workmen, you know, guys who could stones together that so they wouldn't fall down. And that's one of those things that's interesting because you can speculate, you can't prove, but you can speculate that there's a connection between the Masonic component, you know, literally the Masons who were part of this Templar corporate structure, and the later Masonic lodges that developed, maybe or maybe not, but there certainly was that element which was there. So what was this business end they got? What really sort of made this corporate structure possible? What paid for all of these 15,000 to 20,000 people? The Templars basically did two things. As early as about 1122, they started buying land. Remember, many of them were sort of rich guys to begin with, so they began buying land in Palestine and Syria, you know, in the Crusader states themselves, and then that expanded to buying land throughout Europe, and this eventually would develop into a kind of real estate empire of around 9,000 to 10,000 separate properties.
Wow.
That were then spread everywhere from England to Portugal, from Poland to Syria. So in fact, you could, at its height, you could go pretty much anywhere within Christian Europe and in the Crusader-controlled Near East, and you could find Templar properties. And these could be anything from large estates to simple homes or castles. So they acquired a great deal of real estate, and remember, at that time in particular, land was wealth. So that was the key part of it was simply their real estate empire. And then you can see why they needed Masons in order to keep all of these things in repair.
Precisely. Yeah, precisely. It's well, either cheaper to have your own Masons and train your own Masons, or especially whenever you were getting into the type of architecture that Templars were really doing. Very, very specific architecture. It was not just slapping some things together to make a square, folks. Very intricate, amazing stuff.
You got a castle somewhere, you know, the Croc de Chevalier somewhere in what's now Lebanon, sitting up in a hill. Well, you know, something breaks down, the knights aren't going to fix it.
Okay. Exactly.
Okay. Okay. The sergeant, you know, the knights probably aren't going to fix it. In fact, it's going to come down to some fairly lowly commoner. You know, the Masons are going to come in. So they maintain their own sort of corporate squad of Masons who were a portion of this. But it's a large organization. Okay. It's not just a group of knights running around fighting. It's this whole sort of, it's really this kind of corporate structure.
Yeah.
The other thing they get involved in, which maybe even made more money than all the real estate, and literally money as opposed to potential money, is they got into banking. So this, of course, leads to lots of stories that the Templars essentially founded modern banking. Well, they didn't really invent it. Okay, I don't think they invented anything new in the concept of banking itself.
Yeah, it was a pretty borrowed system.
But they added a few twists to it, but it was one of those things they did, and much of that had to do with that there was a huge amount of traffic which was going back and forth from, let's say, France or Western Europe primarily, again to the Eastern Mediterranean and the whole Holy Land, the Crusader states. And that was a considerable journey at the time. And also keep in mind at the time, if you were talking about money, you were basically talking about specie. You were talking about metal coins.
That's right.
I mean, I'm not even talking about paper money at this point.
Yeah.
So if you wanted to carry a lot of money, you know, with you on your trip to Jerusalem, and you wouldn't have traveler's checks or a debit card, you'd have to carry along bags of gold and silver.
Yeah.
Which are heavy and easily stolen. So what the Templars, again, I don't think the Templars necessarily invented this, but what they implemented very successfully was a fairly sophisticated system of essentially establishing counting houses or banks. So let's say you wanted to go from Paris. You were, you know, let's say you were someone who wanted to be, play Templar for a while. You wanted to become a confrere, and you were going to have to take some money with you to support you while you were off adventuring in the Holy Land. But you didn't want to carry a lot of bags of gold and silver. So what you would do is that you would essentially take the money and deposit it with a Templar bank in Paris, or a branch there, and they would issue you a piece of paper that said X amount of money, gold and silver, had been received. And then that would be communicated to their branch in Jerusalem, so that when you reached Jerusalem, you would have that money on credit, and you could draw the gold and silver there without the need to transfer it.
That's right.
They even had secret codes embedded in the letter you would carry. You know, sort of your PIN number.
Yeah, yeah.
So that when you got to Jerusalem, the people there would know that you were the person who that letter was issued to.
Yeah, it was unique ciphers that you gave them, things like that. It was really an advanced system in that right. And I think that's what most people are confusing, is it's really that first, quote, promissory note that they came up with. Not necessarily banking as a whole, but it is interesting, especially knowing that at the time, one of the great blessings that you could do was the corporal work of mercy known as ransoming the imprisoned, because of course people were taken prisoner and captured all the time in the Holy Land. So if you were somebody of means, it was even more blessing for you if you could go and ransom somebody out of captivity back to their family.
Yeah, and plus, you know, also having money in case you needed ransom for yourself.
Right.
That's one of the reasons why you might want to have a sizable amount of money in the bank in case you were captured by the Saracens, and the Saracens would want money, and then you would then have them to pay it. But it was a way of, the thing that had to make this work, though, is that for Templars to accept, let's say, a deposit in Paris and then to pay out funds in Jerusalem or wherever that might be, very distant places, meant that they had to have a lot of cash on hand. Right. They had to be able, so someone, you know, deposited 10,000, I don't know, florins, let's say, in Paris. Well, when they got to Jerusalem, if they wanted that 10,000 florins, that meant that the Templars there had to be able to provide that immediately. So they were dealing with lots of money, and they were dealing also with the basis of wealth in terms of the ownership of land. And that's the root of success and the power of the order. It's also the root of their downfall, because wealth and power eventually breeds jealousy and avarice. And as the order began to decline, the Crusades petered out. The Western Crusaders lost, in fact, the Templars specifically lost the last foothold in the Holy Land around 1291. So after that, the Crusader states were gone. The Templar organization still existed, but they simply weren't as big a deal as they had been before. Much of Christendom was sort of tired of the Crusades. It's even more difficult to get popes to declare one. And so the order began to decline. So by the time you get to about 1300, you know, a few decades after the loss of that last foothold, the order's probably shrunk to about half its size. It's probably more like 10,000 as opposed to 20,000. So still, that would mean about 1,000 knights overall, plus all the other groups that we had described. But it was an organization which was in decline, and it no longer had the political protection it had. And the most important thing that the Templars had always had in terms of political protection, remember, was that special relationship with the Pope.
That's right.
Report to him.
Yeah.
Well, what changed for the worse for the Templars was that something else that had happened by 1300 is that you had the rise of sort of gangster monarchs. So if you tend to look around in that period, the High Middle Ages, you can find a number of European rulers who are you know, essentially they're glorified bandits and murderers. But they're rather hard-nosed. We think of them more as sort of a Pablo Escobar character, you know, running a country on that basis than anything else. And one of the best examples of that was a king of France called Philip IV, Philip the Fair. And he wasn't called the Fair because he was even-handed. Apparently he thought he was pretty. But Philip the Fair was essentially one of these gangster monarchs. Philip had fought lots of wars unsuccessfully. He'd squandered most of his money, and therefore he was desperate to find more. You know, he's trying to run a state, he's trying to increase the size and power of France, and to do that he needs cash, or things he can turn into cash. And he begins looking for any kind of, you know, stone that he can squeeze to get something out of. And you can get a hint of his sort of modus operandi is that about the year before he turns on the Templars, he turns on the Jews. There weren't a lot of Jews in the Kingdom of France, but most of them were involved in commerce. They couldn't own land, so they were involved in business or commerce. Some of them were involved in money change. So cash tended to flow through the Jewish communities that also tended to be fairly small and neatly compacted into larger cities like Paris. So what Philip did was to simply, on one day, have all the Jews in France arrested, at least all the ones with money, and essentially demand that they pay a ransom to be let go, and then take their stuff and then kick them out of the country. All right? That's what he did. He simply robbed all the Jews in France.
Yeah.
And that worked out pretty well. You know, nobody really protected them in any particular way. But, of course, it didn't get him that much money, most of which he squandered on something else. The other thing about Philip is that he got a one-up on the Pope. So the papacy had also changed over the last couple of hundred years. And it wasn't what it quite always was either. And basically, it's a kind of complicated story, but, you know, anybody who's sort of, you know, dipped their toe into medieval history and especially church history knows that eventually the Catholic Church goes through this thing called the Great Schism, or Schism, if you prefer, sure. In which at one point there's not one pope, there are two, and then there are three. And that goes, goes on for a couple of centuries until you get back to one pope. And Philip played his role in that. Basically, what Philip did is that he wanted the Pope to do what Philip wanted him to do. When he didn't, he sent some guys to Rome to beat him up, and the Pope died. And then he forces a French Pope to be placed on the throne, and then carries him off and essentially plants him in France, in Avignon. So he carries the, you know, he decides, you know, I'm going to make you Pope, and furthermore, I'm going to bring you to France, where I can protect you better.
Yeah.
So Pope Clement, the guy who gets involved in the downfall of the Templars, is kind of a semi-prisoner pope. I mean, he really wants to be pope, and he takes his job seriously. But the point is, the guy who's really calling the shots is Philip. And Philip is most interested in money. And now, without the papacy, without the church itself to protect them, so Philip can go after them. And the way that he can go after them is to accuse them of being idolaters and blasphemers and heretics. And that certainly would then justify seizing all of their prey. It's just a bigger operation of what he did to the Jews, and therefore in 1307, he swoops down on the Templars in France.
Actively owed money to, correct?
Yeah. Okay,
yeah,
like the Templars loaned money to people, and so he had borrowed money from them that he couldn't. There wasn't really any way that they could foreclose on him.
Yeah,
they could embarrass him. I mean, to show you how sneaky Philip was, the Templars are arrested in October the 13th.
Yeah.
On a Friday.
Yeah.
Okay, which supposedly is where we get the unlucky day, but that's what it was. And he had actually sent out this order secretly to his officials, his seneschals throughout his kingdom, saying that about a month ahead of time, saying, I'm sending you a letter here, deals with the templates. You know, don't open it until a few days before, you know, early October, and then keep it secret. So he had clearly plotted this. And I want to sort of bring up that point to suggest that if anybody ever wonders if there was a conspiracy involving the Templars, well, there sure as hell was.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a conspiracy against them by Philip of France.
That's right.
I mean, I don't know any way to describe that. He conspired with the officials of his court. He even conspired with people within the Vatican.
That's right.
In order to get his hands on the Templars wealth. But you had to discredit them to do that. And to do that, you had to prove that they were, you know, bad people.
Yeah, and that's really where the accusations against Jacques de Molay and the other heads of the order, the real Templars, like you were saying, the great minority, who were the Brother Knights, were they...
And it's... Yeah, it's he has to, you know, the rest of the organization will collapse without them. So
yeah,
all he has
exactly.
to do is to discredit the key figures in it. Now, here again, it's worth looking at numbers, because, again, the general picture you get is that Philip swoops down on the Templars, accuses them of being heretics, the whole organization is rounded up, they're all tortured, they're confessed to various blasphemous things, and then they're all burned at the stake in a giant holocaust.
Yeah.
That's cinematic, but that isn't what happened.
Okay. Yeah.
Remember?
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole process is going to take 7 years. It actually has much more to do with judicial process. It's also relatively bloodless. It also never really deals with the whole Templar organization. So, remember, I said the Templars have stuff all over Europe, from Poland to Portugal.
Yeah.
And they still have thousands of estates. And in France, let's say that in 1307, the order was maybe 10,000. Out of the total 10,000 organization, only about 2,500, you know, somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 Templars of all types are in France.
Yeah.
So that's it. You know, Philip has under his control maybe a third, a quarter to a third of the whole order he can really get his hands on. Now, true, those are the important people, like the Grand Master, and France was the most important province or sort of territory that the Templars had. But there's no way that he can round up the entire organization. And even of those 2,000 to 3,000 Templars in France, there are only about 500 who are actually arrested. So most of them, again, most of them being commoners, that is, you know, squires.
Yeah.
Masons, they don't touch those. So they round up the knights and some of the others. So, you know, he's got maybe 500. Out of those, about 130 or so are actually subjected to rough questioning, which does include torture in
yes.
most cases. And of those 130 or so, 30, including de Molay, the Grand Master, confess to charges that would substantiate charges, basically of blasphemy, which is what they were accused of.
Yeah, it was things such as idol worship, homosexual sex, and their initiation rites.
Yeah.
Things like we were saying, that the main reason to target the brotherhood, the ones that had taken the vows, was once you discredit them, it's very easy for the rest to tumble. So all you had to do was find some way, which in that day of witch trials and, you know, Malleus Maleficarum, things like that, was definitely very easy to use spectral evidence, to use hearsay evidence against somebody.
You know, it depended upon, you know, you had many different countries. So the law in France was one thing. It was whatever Philip said it was. I mean, but in Scotland or in areas of Germany or in Aragon or in Portugal or in Italy, it was different. So in some of those places, torture was used. In other cases, it wasn't. Outside of France, I mean, keep in mind, most of the Templars in France are the part of the organization. One, aren't arrested at all. Most of those who are arrested are not really questioned, and most of those who are questioned don't confess to anything. Basically, one guy, I think, among the French, confesses to sodomy. All right. That's it. One guy. Okay. So it's not like there's this general confession to it.
Yeah.
And so the amount of evidence is scant. It's not clear that anybody, much even in France, takes it too seriously. Like, and Philip can make, in France, he can make it happen if he wants to. But he can't really enforce his will elsewhere in Europe. So while there are arrests and trials of Templars in places like Scotland and Ireland and in Germany, even in Poland, in most cases they're acquitted. The organization really isn't touched. And in other places, like for instance in Portugal, the King of Portugal is a great fan of the Templars, and so when the church bans the order, all the king does is let them change their name to the Order of Christ, and they just continue on without a beat. They don't lose anything. So it's an interesting, it's, I think to me, it's a very important part, because the conception that the whole Templar organization is destroyed is not true.
Yeah.
Most of it remains intact, which raises the question, what happens to it? In other words, once the Templars sort of lose the ability to call themselves Templars, there is still, even without a Grand Master, there is still this organization of thousands of people which is never destroyed.
That's
and
right.
Which then sort of just fades away. But, you know, they don't cease to exist. Organizations and human beings don't just evaporate. They continue as something else. And I think that's one of the real historical puzzles. So, basically, you know, Philip gets the Pope to first go along with the arrest of the order. But, you know, Clement has his real doubts about this. And it wasn't until 2001 that somebody was, you know, poking around in the Vatican archives, and they came across a document from 1308 called the Chinon Parchment. And in that, the Pope basically says, you know, I don't think they really, you know, they might have been doing some kind of weird stuff, but I don't think they're blasphemers and they're not yeah. heretics. And I don't really think the order should be banned. So the Pope never really goes along. I mean, he's kind of compelled
yeah.
by the fact that he's essentially a prisoner, for the most part, of Philip, but his heart really isn't in it. And so things then go from there. There are other trials that follow. Jacques de Molay, the last Grand Master, of course, the centerpiece of the whole thing, does confess to various blasphemous charges. But then around, I think, 1312, the tide seems to be, there's kind of, you know, years have passed. Philip really, and the other thing that Philip never gets his hands on is that he never gets his hands on the money.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The treasure. He never finds his, you know, he gets his hands on the lands and so on, but he thinks there's this huge Templar treasure, and it never turns, which is why de Molay and the other, and his key lieutenants are not killed early on, because the idea seems to have been, if you can essentially keep them prisoner, eventually they'll crack and they'll ransom themselves by coming up with the money.
Yeah.
So, see, that becomes another part of this Templar mythos. The Templars in their history did have access and control of large amounts of money. How much cash they had on hand in 1307, we don't know. Maybe most of the cash assets were gone by that time. Maybe they were hidden away. We simply don't know. Philip yeah. believed they were there, but he never found them. And then that's one of these things that leads to the story that, well, what they must have done is they put them on boats and sent them off to New World and buried them on Oak Island.
Well, and exactly, yeah. that's where you come to the many theories of even Christopher Columbus being tied in with the Templars, because, of course, his boats flew the Templar flag on their sails. Rather, their sails were a large Templar flag, red cross on a white field. And, you know, like we're saying, it's permeated through history. this interesting story of what happened to them. Because, sure, it's not like modern day where the office shuts down and it's going to be like a phone tree, you know? And never, like, the 2,000 people that work at the office are going to know within 15 minutes that the office is closed because of a snow delay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there were skirmishes going on almost 10 years after the Civil War because of lack of communication. So you can imagine what it was like for knights that were still remnant in the East, knights that were remnant along that Pilgrim Trail, things like that. So,
yeah, I mean, remember, keeping in mind that since most of the Templar organization was still intact.
That's right.
There were people. There were plenty of people.
Yeah.
You know, there were thousands of people
mm-hmm.
who could have taken control of this wealth. The point is, we don't know how much was there. We don't know whether there was a treasure to begin with.
Yeah.
And if there was a treasure, we have no real idea of whatever became of it. And that, again, is one of these kind of, you know, a vacuum. It's this kind of empty spot, this blank spot on the map of history that there have been all of these attempts ever since to kind of fill in. Well, the Templar must be here. The Templar treasure must be in one place or another. Could it have been put on boats and sent to Nova Scotia? Sure, it could have. Is that probably what happened? Almost certainly not.
But it
gives you an idea as to how that very idea could exist, because what you deal with is just this kind of disappearance of something. In the same way that the Templar organization, which isn't destroyed, is still basically intact, just kind of historically disappears. So could it have become the Freemasons? Yeah, kind of. Does that prove that it did? No.
No.
It's simply something that can be brought in to explain, you know, something that should be there that we can't find anymore. So this would seem to be the answer for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, to me, that in a way actually makes it more interesting. It keeps you looking for the truth or to try to find that.
Yeah.
I always kind of suspect if we knew what the real story was, it probably wouldn't be quite as exciting or sexy or intriguing as we would hope it would be.
Well, and
so,
you know, the last time,
no, no, yeah,
last time you were on, the one thing that I loved that you said was that it, over your years of researching into the world of espionage, into things like this, you're likely to believe anything now. There are just all kinds of crazy stories out there. There's all kinds of stuff out there, and it really is a history is written by the winners type situation, where all too frequently we find something out. As we discussed in the last show, it was mythos that the city of Troy existed.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you can find out that, I mean, Troy is an interesting case of where, you know, people in the ancient world knew about it, and then its location was lost, and then it was just assumed that, well, it never existed, you know, because it's the 19th century, and I don't know where it is, and I'm a scholar, therefore it never existed at all, because,
yeah,
you see.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it then takes an amateur to go out and actually find that, yes, it was there all. You know, it's not exactly the way that Homer describes it, but it is there. I think one of the things that, you know, maybe going back to what I said last time, if I didn't, I'll say it this time, is that having studied, you know, mostly modern, but, you know, if by compulsion in some cases, more older history, the thing is that I'm less and less absolutely certain of anything.
Yeah.
And that's simply because there's so much, it becomes extremely difficult to separate the mythology from the relatively few facts that you know.
Yeah.
And therefore, that creates the possibility of all kinds of things, but it erodes the sort of certainty about them. And, you know, other than the fact that you can say the Templars came into being at point A, they officially go out of business at point B, and they accomplish a number of things in between, that's pretty much the factual basis of it right there. Everything else is open to a certain degree of controversy or interpretation. In other words, it's an opinion as opposed to a fact.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And perhaps a well-interpreted opinion, perhaps a well-researched opinion, but still no less than what I do on this show whenever I say, this is what I think, folks. you know, given what I've seen at hand and at my disposal, this is the conclusion I've drawn. And it's very much that way in the case of most history that we know as of right now, unless it's very recent modern history. Once you step back beyond that 150-year, maybe 200-year barrier where there was really correspondence regularly.
The further back you go, the vaguer it becomes. And think of it this way. The vaguer it becomes until basically it just stops.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we talk about, you know, the beginnings of civilization in Mesopotamia. Well, you know, it was probably, there was something going on. Human beings have been doing something for 100,000 years. And if you think about it, most of the time that human beings have existed in this world as human beings, we know absolutely nothing about what they were doing. It is
That's
a complete
right.
blank.
Yeah.
It's just a dark room with the lights off. And it's not until you get to about 8,000 years ago that, you know, you begin to find that there are enough people growing vegetables somewhere around the Nile or the Euphrates that we say that civilization began.
Yeah.
And that's just because, you know, based upon what we found and the thing, you know, like the Sumerians. We know nothing about the Sumerians.
Next to nothing, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we don't know where their language came from. We don't know where they came from. They don't seem to fit in with anybody else. And then you've got the oldest ruins in that whole area, you know, the Göbekli Tepe, the things that go back to about 10 or 11,000 years ago, which weren't supposed to exist, but do.
Yeah.
Well, recent, who built them?
We don't know. Like in the world of archaeology, very recent discoveries.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't know who built them. We don't know why they built them.
Yeah.
and that, it's just there, okay? It's just this thing which is there. But then what you'll notice is that, you know, there will be a whole series of theories over what this was built for. But those are simply theories. We don't know who built them and we don't know why. That's the simple basis of it.
Well, and really the thing is, though, what I truly love about you is the exploration of theory and the necessity of exploration of theory, and the fact that without that we don't get to fact.
Well, I want to make it clear that, you know, if it comes to something like, you know, the Templars on Oak Island,
yeah.
I don't have anything against that idea. I mean, if you could actually find proof that that was true, I would think that would actually be pretty cool.
Yeah,
you know, that would be something. So I'm not really trying to prove or disprove anything.
No.
And I think that's the kind of trap in itself, because, you know, once you decide that you're going to commit yourself to debunking something, then you only begin to look at one side of it. And once you've signed on as a true believer to something else, you only look at that side.
Yeah.
I just kind of let the chips fall where they may. You know, either you got evidence for it or you don't have evidence for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the probability of it being true pretty much depends upon how much evidence you can muster. So, you know, what do you got? But, you know, if you can show me.
And that's just it. Like, I'm not going to lie, Doc. When I am typically on the road the way I am, that's normally what I'm watching, because I don't actively have cable. I just have internet. So I don't pay for History Channel. I pay for things like Great Courses because it's awesome. I think it's really cool the fact that I can just roll around on my mobile device and listen to lectures on particle physics, things like that.
That's why it's such a great deal out there. I'm doing my work as corporate shill.
Hey,
shill it up. It actually is a pretty good deal.
Oh no,
they have all different ways that you can buy them. I mean, you can get the audio, or you can get all the bells and whistles with the different productions. You know.
Yeah, it's great.
Whatever fits your price point.
Yeah, I literally turned it on the screen over my shoulder over here while I'm working in the studio, things like that, and just turn on programs and listen to them. It's fantastic. It's great. And to know that that is out there now, I think a lot of this, especially with social media, that kind of stuff, has really opened up a new realm of research. At the same time, I think it's opened up a new level of obfuscation to real research, and to people trying to do good things. Like, hey, I love my Oak Island whenever I'm on the road. I love nothing more than sitting back on a Thursday night with a bottle of something and just watching Oak Island for hours while I code websites on the road. But it is one of those, you have to take it with a tablespoon of salt.
You know, I think they have to make it interesting.
Okay? Well, sure.
You got to make the show interesting. And throwing in the Templars, you know, makes it more interesting. And
I watched every one. They found some cool stuff. I'm not going to lie.
They do. They find some interesting stuff. Of course, you know, if they actually find the treasure vault, then the show's over.
Sure, sure. Absolutely.
So there's this whole built-in thing that you can't really kind of get to the mystery until you've exhausted it, I guess.
Right, right.
But
yeah. And, you know, what's funny is I had Bingo Minerva, one of the head, he is the head researcher for Lost Gold, the World War II, on the show.
Ah.
And to talk to him about researching that and researching the treasure of Yamashita and that kind of stuff was like, wow, like, how did you get into that world, man? Like, you came from a world of real estate. And this hobby just kind of turned into a show with some other people.
Well,
and it's really kind of cool.
All you have to do with humans is, whisper the word gold. and that will get a lot of people going. Gold, there's a hidden treasure.
Well,
so
and let's kind of use that as a spin point right now to kind of start going into the world of the Rosicrucians. Because this is one that really popped up on my radar. It was probably right up around the time of Dan Brown, things like that. Whenever the word Rosicrucian first started popping up in conversations amongst friends, whenever we'd talk Knights Templar, things like that. And through years of research, it's really more like I love reading alchemical texts and documents. They're fun to me. It's kind of like reading old prose, you know. There's just this really interesting way that alchemists speak and put their words together to try and code things. It's really interesting.
They're speaking in code all the time.
Oh, yeah, it's great. And it's just this beautiful form of poetry that's there that's like, okay, so you threw some stuff in some acid. Cool.
Okay.
And, but they were ones that really people tied to the Templars tried to say that, you know, held the secrets of the elixir of life, secrets of turning lead into gold, that kind of stuff. A lot of what they actually tried to accuse the Templars of in a few cases.
Well, yeah, the Templars, among everything else, get accused of practicing various forms of sorcery. You know, that was one of the... It might pick up from... I think there was one little thing that maybe... To kind of not leave a loose end out there.
Oh,
you
no,
know,
no, go ahead, go ahead, tie
the
it
last
up.
Grandmaster Jacques de Molay, you know, 7 years after the initial arrest in March of 1314, he and I think three or four of his key lieutenants are burned at the stake in Paris. And this was sort of Philip's last, you know, he was kind of fed up. But what the reason for that was that de Molay and the others renounced their previous confessions. So they abjured their confessions. If they hadn't done that, it would have been, you know, the Pope would have, you know, I'm not sure how much he could have resisted. It would have been much more difficult or politically complicated for Philip to kill them. But so the reasons for that are also unclear. One argument is that de Molay had come to the conclusion that he was never going to be released, that Philip was always going to keep him a prisoner, and he was going to force him to kill him. He was going to force him to execute them. And so that's essentially why they're killed. They say all that stuff we said before about the things we did with Baphomet, that's all a lie. And now what are you going to do about it? And so they were executed as relapsed blasphemers, sort of relapsed heretics in that case. But it gives you, Demolay is an example. He's one of the best examples I can give as to how the whole sort of, see, from that point on, the Templars cease really being an historical, or, you know, they're the organization is still there. Most of the people who were in the organization were running around. We don't know what they're doing. They just, you know, again, somebody switches off the lights and you don't see them, and historically they cease to exist, although physically they didn't cease to exist. Centuries later, in the 19th century, in America, American Freemasons decide that they're going to name their Masonic Boys Auxiliary after a noble and heroic historical figure, none other than Jacques de Molay.
Uh-huh.
So the de Molays, you know, anybody out there who's been a de Molay, which again is sort of the, you know, Boys Auxiliary of American Freemasonry, that's who they're named after. They are named after the last Grand Master of the Templar Order who was burned at the stake as a relapsed blasphemer. But to the Masons,
imagine
to the American Masons
while you're
of the
making
19th
s'mores,
century,
kids.
He's a hero.
Yeah. Well, that's just it. Really, at that point, when he cursed the Pope and the King of France on the stake, supposedly, like as his final words, laying a curse on them.
They would all follow him in death within a year, which, by the way, they all do.
They did, yeah. Strangely, oddly enough. And
maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not. Okay, who knows?
Yeah, but...
Maybe all that stuff about black magic was true.
Well, and that's just it. It really was, at that point, the springboard into infamy and really mythology that we see today. That was the birth of all of it.
But I think that's, you know, that centuries later in a country that didn't even exist at the time among people, the de Molay, this guy who was, you know, essentially politically executed in the early 14th century, has now emerged in Freemasonry as a noble and hero, as a kind of martyr, which we're then going to name our boys' organization after. And that tells you something about, I think, the sort of the continuing myth of this thing. And that's why it shouldn't surprise you that Templars still get roped into the whole Oak Island saga, because you can rope them into everything.
Oh, yeah.
Really. And it's not so much that you can... I think that the power of this isn't that you can prove any of it, but that you can't disprove it. There you go.
Indeed, absolutely. And that's the most powerful part of any, quote, conspiracy theory, is that, you? I mean, whether it's laid out by a DA or whether it's laid out by a book author, folks, and I posit the fact all the time that DAs are our best conspiracy theorists out there. They literally do it for a living. that's their job.
That's quite true. If you're prosecuting somebody under the RICO Act,
absolutely,
you have to prove they're acting as a criminal conspiracy.
That is correct. So, yeah, it is one of those, it's a strange thing to look at these things through the light of history and actually start to just kind of step back and be willing to step back from it. I myself, you know, I know I've mentioned it to you before, I'm a fourth degree Knight of Columbus, love all that stuff, but it's one of those, whenever I get together with my fellow Colombians and we're having a beer or a cigar or something and talking at a Christmas party or things like that, sometimes I have to be like, hey, hold up, you know Columbus was actually a pretty bad dude, right? Like, he was not a nice human being.
Like, well, I don't know. Did you ever meet him?
I didn't meet him, but I mean, at least as far as the annals of history, and if you go through and read quite a few accounts, there was some pretty bad stuff that happened. Although there was pretty bad stuff that happened all across the board.
Yes, you know, and I don't want to come across as an
apologist,
a Columbus apologist.
Yeah,
nor was a persecutor. I mean,
say,
you know, Columbus lived and died, and he did what he did. Okay, none of that can be changed one way or the other. And this is what we do with, you know, Jacques de Molay, whatever he really was, gets turned into a kind of, you know, superhero for Freemasons, all right? Columbus gets turned into a kind of superhero for Catholic Freemasons.
Absolutely.
But the people that were really, you know, whoever these people really were just gets lost in the process. And I think in many cases we don't really see the people anymore. We just see the kind of legend.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. The legend that someone else has created. So, I mean, that would be this quite, you know, if you were to actually meet Cristoforo Colombo, I mean, would he kind of live up to your expectations of heroism or villainy? Or would he just be kind of a terribly exceptional, more or less ordinary, kind of likable guy who could also be, I mean,
And if you flipped the tables, like I recently had somebody that I worked with previously get rid of a reporter because of a documentary they put out. That implicated somebody that they knew in something. And it was like, what's wrong? Are you afraid to be confronted with the truth there? You know? And we do kind of have that blind allegiance very, very frequently when it comes to history. You know, where we don't want to tarnish the good reputation of somebody for the last 1,500 years, but... I mean, hey, even the church came back and said, yo, Galileo, sorry about that, man.
Yeah, mistakes were made.
Yeah. Exactly. Open-minded conversations happened. We're very sorry.
I kind of have a... I can't say I'm greatly moved by historical apologies. So...
Yeah.
Again, what was done, right? You can't really change that, and well, you don't have to go on agonizing about it the whole time. It doesn't really, you know, I mean, really, as an historian, as a professional, you know, recounter of historical tales, someone who tries, you know, is supposedly trying to piece together what truth you can out of these things, it has crossed my mind on occasion as to whether or not I am not helping create a gigantic disservice to humanity by simply perpetuating the knowledge of things that maybe we'd all be better off forgetting.
Wow.
Now, that's a weird thing for an historian to say, and yet you know, because a lot of the stuff that passes in history, you know, there's a lot of art and music and poetry and nice things that come along. But most of it is literally just a litany of atrocities.
Oh, yeah. All of that stuff is born of horrible, horrible things.
Okay. It's terrible things. It's murder and bloodshed, rape and robbery on a massive scale. Why we didn't kill ourselves off years ago, I have no idea. I
mean, yeah.
And yet, while that's interesting, see, the thing is that's interesting. It's one of those things that, you know, in some way, it, you know, it's interesting, like a fire is interesting, or a disaster is interesting. And it's, you know, in some ways, studying history is like you know, cruising slowly by a fire, by an accident. It's sort of rubbernecking on tragedy in some respects.
Mm.
And I've never tried to focus on that, but it's inevitably. I mean, another course that I taught, certainly as often as secret societies, was one in the history of warfare.
Yeah.
And you know, the history of warfare. You know, that was, you know, sort of looking at the evolution of warfare, you know, economically, we're just refighting battles, but, you know, it's pretty much begins that, you know, human history is violent. You know, most people tend to get along most of the time, but every now and then, you know, quite frequently they don't. And this is just this kind of constant within human history. I don't think it's something that we do accidentally. We do it because it's kind of built into us.
Yeah.
For one reason or another. And yet... But, you know, I have considered as to whether or not it's just sort of, in some ways, keeping the collective memory alive of horrible things.
Yeah.
That otherwise maybe doesn't serve our best overall interest in knowing about. And it's
It's kind of like I posit to my wife all the time. Imagine hundreds of years from now, somebody runs across a hard drive and is able to just recover what's there. And that's the only glimpse and lens they have into this time period is what they see on that hard drive. Like, you know, kind of a myopic view, whatever that person was browsing, whatever that person was looking at and doing and how they were.
Whatever kind of porn they were into.
Yeah. You know, and hey, no judgment. You know, it's America. Do your thing, folks. But it really is an interesting rabbit hole to intellectually dig down once you start getting into it because, you know, like you're saying, it is a fatalist concept to think about. I mean, it's a really easy way to think yourself out of a job as a professor.
Yeah. Well, I've said that these ideas have crossed my mind. They've never actually stopped me from recounting any horror.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I mean, I'll just do it. And it's because, you know, generally that's what it is that people want to hear.
Well,
and it was like the argument I heard from, you know, another fellow academic who was, you know, his interesting statement was there's no such thing as an anti-war movie.
Mm.
Okay, everybody tends to think that, you know, everything's going to build themselves as anti-war movies.
Yeah.
But he goes that the mere fact that you're making a movie about violent combat or you're including something in it and that the parts that people will remember are the violent parts. The battle scenes.
Yeah.
Okay. Even an anti-war movie has a graphic battle scene, and that's the one thing that people remember because that's the thing that visually and cinematically and sort of emotionally is the most compelling part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it really is one of the psychological concepts we talk about on the show all the time is the fact of negative reinforcement. And how in nature, like if you go back to our primal state of being, negative reinforcement was it's what kept us alive. Learning that fire was hot, like my son is just under 3.5 and just learned the lesson that fire is hot. Now, he's been told fire is hot his whole life. But he just recently learned it by reaching for a piece of bacon that we told him was hot. And it was hot.
Now he knows what hot means.
And it's really interesting once you start digging into that fact that negative reinforcement is one of the most positive grounding forces that we have as far as driving something home in our mind. And when you can hijack that, you know, like you're saying, in a war film, even though it's an anti-war film, what's still going to be remembered is the parts about war.
Yes, you're still selling war.
That's right.
And here's the idea was that there's no way you can't do that because the more horrific you make it, in some ways, the more attractive you make it.
Yeah.
In that respect. Anyway, you know, that leads us off in a completely different direction is what's the matter with people, which I don't know.
It really is an interesting study, though, because it does bring us to the point of why a lot of people, like we explored in the last edition that we had you on, where we went into the history of the Masons in America and how so many people intrinsically tie that to horrible things. The worlds do kind of cross over, and it's weird and it's strange.
Well, you know, it's bringing us back to where we're going is to why people become Rosicrucians.
Yes.
And what it is that Rosicrucians is the first place I ever, and this is probably true for a lot of people listening, ever ran into the term Rosicrucian was the version of the Rosicrucians that was and still is, so far as I know, headquartered in San Jose, California.
Yep.
And it's one of the things that that in the lecture, the Great Courses lecture, I sort of start out with. And, you know, that's, you know, founded by a guy, you know, in the early 20th century United States named, you know, H. Spencer Lewis. And he essentially, you know, created a kind of occult secret society theme park, you know, Egyptian theme, Secrets of the Universe. And he started the ancient and mystical order of the Rosy Cross Amorc. And I remember as a kid seeing that advertised on the back of comic books or magazines.
Oh, wow.
They used to be pretty common. If you look at the thing, you know, what were they all, you know, always this ad, you know, basically on the back of, let's say, something like Amazing Stories or Popular Science. And, you know, usually it would feature a drawing. Usually there was a skull and a spider web and an ancient book. Okay. And he would say, do you want to know the suppressed knowledge? This is what H. Spencer Lewis's American Rosicrucian organization was selling in the 20th century. Do you want to know the suppressed knowledge of the ages? Do you want to know the secret method for the mastery of life? Do you want to know the psychic power of attraction? Do you want to possess the secrets entrusted to the few? Well, yeah.
The
now,
answer
all
is
you have
yes.
to do is you just send off, you know, a dollar for your first lesson, and you know it was really sort of mail order mysticism. That was H. Spencer Lewis's great contribution to this sort of democratizing of
the X-ray glasses
wisdom.
Version.
Yeah, but the interesting thing is that if you go through this, okay, they're selling ancient wisdom, suppressed knowledge of the ages, secret methods of mastery of life, psychic power of attraction. Well, those all sound great, but what are they exactly? Well, see, that's what you have to pay the money to find out. But it's, and to me, in some way, and I'm not trying to make fun of it, I'm just saying it's like going into a carnival and looking at all the banners along the sideshow. You know, Spider Girl,
yeah.
Alligator Boy, all right? And these are all the wondrous things. Pay your 10 cents and you come in and you will see these wonders. And that's, you know, H. Spencer Lewis was, I'm not saying he wasn't a genuine mystical master, but he was also a very good businessman and a great showman. And there's always that element in it as well.
Sure.
But it sort of comes back to that. The thing that I think I emphasized in that lecture was that, to me, Rosicrucian seemed to be about everything and nothing.
Yeah.
It was always sort of promising to reveal all the secrets, but of course, once those were revealed to you in true secret society methods, you were never supposed to reveal them to anyone else. So, it's selling all kinds of things. I think what it most rests on, though, is that, and the appeal of so much of this is that it comes down to, I think, the most basic gut level human desire, which is not to die.
Yeah.
Okay. That's really.
Yeah.
I think what we want, you know, even beyond sex and money, if they should think that that's possible, the only thing that can trump sex and money. Is, and that wasn't a political statement, by the way. I was just
no.
using the word Trump. Okay.
Yeah.
But is immortality.
Absolutely.
And, you know, then that goes back to this connection between alchemy and Rosicrucianism because, yep. you know, the great work in alchemy, the thing that alchemists actually sought, the pinnacle of the achievement in alchemy, wasn't a cheap parlor trick like turning lead into gold.
Yeah.
It was transforming yourself basically into a god.
That's right.
It was attaining immortality and the ultimate wisdom that would provide. That was the great work. It was a work of, you know, it was a work of self-improvement.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, once you start going through and looking at alchemical texts, you start getting into a lot of the Kabbalistic tree of life. You start getting like it crosses so many different realms of mystical study. It's absolutely phenomenal and so fun just to rabbit hole into in an afternoon. I would probably say that in the
in the last 6-7 months, that's been most of the books that I've just bought ebook versions of. It's just alchemical texts sitting there diving through rabbit holes of that. And it really is about that, that gnosis with a capital G, that, that universal knowledge of, be it, like you're saying, how to transmogrify yourself into a greater being, into somebody or something that can manifest things in the world around you. Through magical means.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about that is you see, if you sort of look at the modern sort of industry of self-improvement, and I don't know how many people within that, you know, even down to the idea that you can be whatever you want to be, you know, you can achieve these things, you can focus your energy, you can overcome your difficulties.
Sure.
You have this tremendous potential that isn't being realized, which you can.
Yeah. Can do whatever you set your mind to, Marty.
And whether they know it or not, they're sort of parroting these alchemical and these Gnostic ideas. I mean, it's kind of Gnosticism for the masses.
Indeed.
You know, Gnosticism, you know, not so much that I'm going to achieve eternal life and know the secrets of the universe and become one with God, but I'm going to become a much better and happier person, and I will achieve all of my personal goals. It's one of these things that, it's a kind of practical occultism.
Okay? Well, and you know, my God, it just, like, fireworks of lines just went off of my head between what we're talking about right now, the means that you're talking about, and Secret Agent 666. Because it is so, so much the way that Crowley controlled his public. And controlled his followers. It is so much a wash, rinse, repeat method.
You know, I guess on one level, they're kind of all snake oil salesmen, but who's to say the snake oil doesn't work?
Well,
if you... you know, someone, since we're on this type of thing... and literally, it was someone, and I don't remember who it was, once described the Disney movie Dumbo as a great Gnostic indoctrination film.
Ooh, interesting.
And you think about it, you know, the whole, the power of belief. You know, Dumbo, because he believes the feather is magic, can fly. That is, he can defy, you know, all sorts of, you know, aerodynamics. And manage to fly, and of course it's not really the feather. It's his belief that carries him through. This is, you know, the sort of mind over matter thing, and the way of convincing yourself, and that their idea was that this was really what it was. You know, all the kids sitting out there watching this is what it was selling you on, that it was this kind of Gnostic message which was being carried across by these cartoon figures. Now, again, maybe. Maybe not, but it can be. I don't think. Yeah, you know, I think if that's what you see in it, then that's what's there, I suppose.
Now, I will say that probably it wasn't the last time, but the time before. Like I said, got a 3-year-old, so Disney movies are a regular in the household. Think what you want, audience. But anyway, I was watching Pinocchio, and it really came across to me as like, wow, this, especially at the time that it happened and came out, what an incredible metaphor for what was going on in the animation industry to begin with, in Hollywood, all kinds of stuff. So it was really interesting to kind of sit there and break down Pinocchio as a study in what was going on in that time.
You can read into Pinocchio, you can read Frankenstein.
Sure.
And you can read the golem. I mean, he's a kind of wooden golem.
Yeah.
that goes out of control. You know, and I don't know, I mean, I could think that maybe I'm just kind of overthinking this, but I think those themes, this is the type of stuff that doesn't just permeate individual people's minds. It permeates a whole sort of culture. It permeates, you know, the kind of collective psychosphere. And it influences things that people create and do and think in a whole. So there are all of this, there's a whole variety of things in popular culture that are essentially immersed or passing on, who have incorporated essentially mystical or occult concepts that we don't even recognize as such. And yet, you know, if you look at Pinocchio, what Geppetto does is that he creates an artificial child. He creates an artificial man who, just like, you know, Victor von Frankenstein, it doesn't quite work out the way that it's supposed to.
Yeah, hijinks ensue.
Yeah. And we won't even mention the fairies that are involved in it and all of those type of things. But
sure.
So, and talking insect, talking animals. So there you have it. It's, you know, it's like... completely immersed in this, and yet it's an innocent children's tale. So it's all of those things and more, I guess.
That's just it. Everything gets woven together, from history to mythos. And when you're talking about stuff like Knights Templar, it can be hard sometimes if you're not used to sifting through to separate myth from fact.
Well, that's always the problem. And, you know, the facts are often so few and the myths are often so appealing. And yeah. I think I'm not sure you can ever keep the two of them entirely separate, because, you know, if you, you know, get rid of one myth, then another one is immediately created. Or often you're just replacing one with the other. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to sort of imply out here that any of this makes the study of history or the rest of this fruitless. I mean, it's exactly the opposite. It's the very thing that makes it energizing and interesting.
Exactly.
And, you know, what I tell people, you know, if you think, the first thing I've always tried to dispel students from in a class is the idea that whatever we're studying is that somewhere there's a book that explains all of this stuff, and I'm just summarizing the book for you. Well, there isn't. Right? There is no huge library of black tomes somewhere that record everything that happened in human history in exact detail. That doesn't exist. Most of it we don't have, and much of what we think we have is, you know, either an outright lie or at least partly one.
Sure.
So the thing is that if you're interested, intrigued in history, remember, the answers for most things aren't there, and you could still discover them. The truth is yet to be known. And it's a little bit like Oak Island. There's something down there. I don't know exactly what it is. And if we keep digging long enough, maybe we'll find it. And
we'll
maybe
find out
that it's just, you know, a rock in a box. Or maybe we'll find the Templar treasure. Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. We'll figure it out whenever we get there. It's a great journey along the way.
Yeah.
But much like with anything, especially whenever you are somebody that is passionate about it, folks. And that's what I have to caution people about. That's what I have to be careful with. Even myself is like, please, God, read beyond the headline. Be willing to accept the fact that your paradigm may change today.
And also accept the fact that if you're reading something, whether it's, you know, standard history or it's, again, the latest news headline, and it doesn't sound quite right, I mean, it sounds kind of fishy. Well, keep thinking about it.
Yeah.
I mean, if it doesn't sound quite right, chances are there is something wrong with it. You're not getting the whole story, or it doesn't. And that, again, is one of those things that you have to keep exploring. You have to keep digging. You have to keep finding new things. And really, that's what keeps all of this interesting for me, is that I find out new things all the time.
And it's mostly because, to use the word in its proper form, you are literally as agnostic about it as you can be.
I suppose that's fair, yeah.
You know,
so it's a,
like, you've got to be willing to accept the fact that something that you believe might be based on something else. You've got to be at least open of mind enough to have the conversation.
Well, and maybe another way that I've occasionally put it is that I'm not sure that I believe in much in anything anymore.
Yeah.
And I believe in this is that I believe that, okay, this is the answer, and that's it. This is it. I found the whole thing. This is the truth, and I believe this in exclusion to everything else. And I don't know really quite where that fits in. You know, to me, pretty much everything is a range of probabilities.
Yeah.
Okay? There are things that, you know, pretty definitely seem to be true, and there are things that are probably true, practically seem to be. There are things that might be true. And then there are things that, you know, unlikely as they seem, could be true. And then there's a lot more stuff that isn't true.
That's right.
So rather than trying to, in the absence of any absolute truth one way or the other, you just accept them as a range of possibilities. So while I really don't think that there's a Templar treasure on Oak Island, I don't dismiss the small possibility that there could be.
Yeah.
Because it ain't anywhere else, is it?
It ain't been found yet.
Yeah. So, yeah. You know.
Yeah.
You know,
precisely.
It's kind of like, you know, I don't want to just, you know, get in an argument with the Bigfoot people, but it's sort of like, I think it would be kind of cool if there was some sort of big simian running around the Pacific Northwest. I live in the Pacific, never seen one. But until I see one,
that's right,
I'm not going to believe in it, okay? I'm not going to disbelieve, I'm not going to reject the possibility, but I'm not going to believe it until you can introduce me to Harry and the Hendersons together, all right? That's what it would take. You have to show me, and then I would believe it. But I'm not going to think that someone is, you know, I don't think you're crazy if you want to. It's not an enthusiasm that I will particularly share.
I could not have put that more brilliantly, because that's absolutely what it is. Like, I myself had an ecstatic spiritual experience at one point in life. Sans any chemical processes, folks, it was way before that point in my life. And I am one of those people that, you can call me crazy all you want, I will never deny that I felt the presence of God at that moment. I'll never deny that.
And who am I or anyone else to say that you didn't?
Well, precisely. Right. Yeah. Precisely. And that's where I come from with it, is that, hey, man, there's a lot of people that would look at me and go, you're a crazy person right now. And I go, well, believe what you want. I know what I felt. I know what was there. Like, beyond any shadow of a doubt, that's what was there for me. So I can't deny anybody's experience. When it comes to that, because that truth, in so to speak, is through our filter of reality.
Well, I think it's something else. It's true again for a lot of this sort of mystical doctrines. You know, whether it's the Rosicrucians or else, it's very personal. In other words, it's a kind of personal experience. And once it happens, I think it's difficult to really convey that to somebody else.
Yeah.
It's sort of like trying to describe a dream.
Mm.
I don't know. Some people have very vivid memories of dreams. Every time I try to describe a dream, it seems to evaporate as I'm trying to describe it.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I kind of have this picture of what was going on, but if I try to describe it, it makes absolutely no sense at all. And then it begins to make no sense to me, and the whole thing just kind of crumbles away. It just sort of dissipates.
Yeah.
And yet it was a very real experience at the time. And I suppose one, I don't know, lesson you could take from that is that it was meant for you, and it's not something that you can actually just sit down and explain to someone.
Yeah.
Because it's such a personalized experience that out of the context of your own experience, it doesn't really make any sense.
Precisely.
If that makes sense.
Yeah. And that's just it. It's something that I can do my best to explain or impart the feeling of, but sans being there in that moment in my shell of a being, it will probably be impossible. And that's literally just the question of faith for most people. And I'd love to have you on sometime, especially before the election, to talk about some of these things that, you know, like we have the documents in our knowledge vault for Operation Mockingbird, proposed, and not just proposed, but carried out by our CIA at one point. These things have been declassified. We know that they've happened. We know that they've had operatives in the U.S. press and in foreign press. Like, it's just, it's mind-numbing, the things that happen on the rags.
Yeah, they cultivated assets. I mean, that's sure. What every intelligence or security agency does, is you cultivate assets in the media. Because you want, you know, the term here is you want to control the narrative.
Yeah.
Right, and which means you want to come up with a, now whether this story is true, you want to come up with a story that you can get other people to push, to get other people to believe it. And it's, look, whether for good or ill, the CIA and its ilk has been messing with all of our heads since 1947.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, whether they're doing it to save us from things or because we're nothing more than, you know, rats in a maze to them, I'm not entirely sure. You know,
yeah.
I don't know about that. But I am certainly convinced that, reasonably, profoundly convinced that, yes, they have been messing with our heads for one dark purpose or another since their inception.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a whole episode unto itself. We've got to have you on to talk about that. Thank you so much for coming on. Really getting into the crux of the Knights Templar this evening, going into the concept of alchemy and what the Rosicrucians were about, at least the concept that we have of them here in America, that kind of stuff. So,
well, we didn't get that far. You know, the Rosicrucians go back further than that. You know, really back to the 17th. But always on the way through, they're always sort of advertising these same thing, the same stuff. You know, we have the secrets of the universe that we will impart to the select few or those who will pay. But we won't tell you what those are until you're recruited or you pay. And I think again, what it boils down to is that if you know the secrets of the universe, then you won't die. And that's the big sell.
Yeah.
So here's the thing you leave you with. Does that mean that it's real, or does it mean that it's just a con?
Well, that's a big bagel hanging out there, for sure. with not a lot of cream cheese on it, for certain.
Yeah.
Because it's a rough question to ask, because that really bears the question of faith for anybody in anything. Like the first place my mind goes after Rosicrucians and what you're just saying is straight up Scientology. L. Ron Hubbard, right after Aleister Crowley, student of Aleister Crowley, very much pulling the same scenario on this side of the pond.
Right. I don't think you would have no problem coming up with any number of people, many of them ex-Scientologists, who would be perfectly willing to say that, yes, Scientology is a con.
Yeah.
All right? It's just a con that's basically, you know, done to separate you from your money and plays upon, you know, your vanity and your desire for knowledge and you not wanting to, you know, the same sort of things there.
Yeah.
And the extension of that, though, is that if, and again, this isn't what I believe, all right? This is just, you know, it's one of the possibilities.
That's right.
Is whether all of these things are a con. By all of them, I mean everything from Judaism, Hinduism to,
absolutely,
you know, Islam and Roman Catholicism and everything else, that they're, every single one of them is a con.
Yep.
Just selling different flavors of the same thing. Now, see, I've managed to insult everyone's
religious beliefs, but that wasn't what I... Equally.
I mean...
But
I mean, look, at some point in anyone, and I had it as well, no matter how, what your religious faith, at certain times, you know, you've got to, you know, wonder, is any of this really true? I mean, is this really what's going on? You know, was she really a virgin? I don't know. I mean, and I think that's kind of a necessary part of it, but it's a, it's not a very palatable idea to believe that, you know, our most of our, or to even, not to believe, but to even posit that most of the sacred ideas and belief systems we have are cons of one form or another. But the thing is that there are real cons, all right?
Sure.
And let's just say, for the sake of argument, I don't want them to sue me, so this is just hypothetical. Let's say Scientology is a con.
They're suing you, they're suing me, brother, and they ain't getting nothing from me.
Okay. It's, you know, that it's not a real religion. It's a phony imitation kind of religion, and it's a con.
Sure.
But the thing is that it works. You know? Look at, you know, it's been very, very successful.
Sure.
And it, in its basic approach, and even in any much of what it's selling, isn't different than other presumably legitimate belief systems.
Absolutely.
So how do you tell the con? How do you tell the real thing from the fake?
Well, and it's hard. It's hard. It's not easy. I mean, hey, I'm guilty of being Roman Catholic. Studied to be a priest for the first year of college. You know, worked as a youth minister after that. All kinds of stuff. I will fully say, like, yeah, we usurped a lot of things, man. like, straight up. To disallow that, to not say it didn't happen, is straight up ignorant. And by ignorant, I mean in the worst sense of the word, Doctor. As in the fact of you have been told different, and you have chosen to keep believing your path.
Well, it's...
It's there. I'd love to say it's not. It is.
So, yeah, well, it comes back to the old saying, it is what it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I, you know, I've always mean is that, you know, look, I'm not really sure whether it's good or bad or indifferent, but it's there, right?
Yeah.
And, it is, or someone else said, it's the turd on the plate. Okay. I don't know why I use that image, but it's just one coming. Okay.
You have
a turd on the plate. Why is the turd on the plate? I don't know. All right.
There it is.
How did it get there? Whose turd is it? I don't. But there is a turd on the plate. That is quite clear.
It's a fact that we need to deal with right now.
Yeah.
And it's an awkward fact to deal with. It's not a fun fact to deal with, but it's a fact. It's there. It exists. Is it something that intrinsically changes things? No. You know? Kind of like the whole concept of does the existence of UFOs preclude Jesus being the Savior? No. No. One does not affect the other. That's just a reason of philosophy. But, yeah, it really is one of those questions of faith come down to individuals, and we can't really do much about that.
Well, that was, another thing that we might discuss at some point, which I'm working on, is one of the things I may have mentioned before that I kind of deliberately ignored or steered clear of was that I would never really go anywhere down the UFO path.
Yeah.
And
I remember us having that conversation prior to show the first time.
Yeah, and it's but I became intrigued by one of the sort of, you know, godfathers of the whole flying saucer mythos, and from the 1950s, a guy named George Hunt Williamson.
Yeah.
And so I just decided that I was going to start investigating, because there were just a lot of things about him that didn't seem to fit together. And so I have to say that it was my first real serious foray into that.
Mm.
And I would say, for what it's worth, that to date, in going through this, I have found nothing that would convince me of extraterrestrial contact on Earth. That doesn't mean they haven't. I just haven't seen, you know, I haven't seen any of them that way. What I have seen in the case of Williamson, and the thing that, you know, the first thing I caught the trail of, is his connection to the military and intelligence agencies and the aerospace industry.
Indeed.
Okay, everywhere I look in that's where these connections go. And it's a, in some ways, I think it makes him more interesting. And again, it doesn't disprove anything, but I think it's one of those things which has been, I think the UFO thing, looking at it, is manipulated for a variety of purposes.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, and the degree of reality of it, I frankly don't know. And I'm not discounting of it, but the one thing that is abundantly clear is that whether it's real or it doesn't, or it isn't real, in some sense, it is manipulated for a variety of purposes, and used basically to manipulate people around it. And I couldn't tell you exactly why that's so important for others to do, but that seems to be the case of it. And it seems to have been what Williamson was doing, is that he was really this kind of
orchestrator,
an agent who was trying to guide people in particular ways. And maybe part of it he believed.
Sure.
And part of it he almost certainly was making up. But that's interesting, see?
And that's just it. It only makes the case clearer when things like that happen, and it really only makes it easier to believe when that person does believe what they're saying.
And I think this is a case of where my not believing, and believing or specifically believing accepting or rejecting anything, makes that somewhat easier to do. But it's the type of thing that I bump into constantly in that, because you constantly bump into people who are, for lack of a better term, true believers in certain things.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
They will not listen to anything else. And if you don't agree with them, then you're a heretic. Or you're trying to tear things down, as opposed to just really figure out, you know, what's going on here, you know.
What
kind of solid things can we really grasp onto?
Well, and that's just it, because it really does come down to and we talked about this in our last episode with you, Doctor, is the religion of history, the rigid religion of science, of this goes against everything that we've taught and been taught for the last 20 years, so it just can't be. Does that necessarily make it so? No.
Nope.
And, you know, we've seen in numerous cases where that comes to light, not just historically, but in the world of ufology, all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be interesting to see. What was it like for you to really get that exposure as someone who even did deep, hard research in the world of espionage for years and years, to really delve into that topic in the way that you did?
Well, the thing that I'm often accused of doing is seeing spies everywhere, okay? So, I'm seeing so many, I think that guy's a spy. And I would say most of the time I'm right. I've kind of learned what to look for. And by a spy, sure. I mean someone who's being used for some sort of intelligence-related purpose.
Yeah.
And by an intelligence-related purpose, it basically boils down to one of two things. You're either trying to get information, or you're trying to conceal information. And you can do that. One of the ways that you conceal information is with disinformation. So, one of the things which is a term which is often used is lead the hounds away from the fox.
Yeah.
So, plausible, interesting, entertaining story, which may in and of itself be largely true, but in some key way is critically misleading. It's leading people away from, I mean, the classic, the thing that I think is that the real leitmotif in this, if you love, is the Benowitz case.
Yeah.
The Paul Benowitz case.
Yeah.
Where the Air Force, by its own admission, basically decided that they were going to feed this guy all kinds of bogus stories. stories that he would believe to essentially lead him away from the secret projects that he was getting too close to, yeah. and convince him instead that there was an army of aliens under a mountain in New Mexico. They were going to take over the Earth unless he did something about it. Yep. And they encouraged him in that belief. And that is a perfect example of disinformation. So they were, to conceal one thing, they were creating this kind of phony story that was leading this guy off in basically insanity in the other direction. And that just goes on a lot. And that's, you know, that's what I mean by the uncertainty principle in history or elsewhere. Are you getting yeah. the real story, or are you getting you're getting a story that's really there to lead you away from the real story? And that was just the type of thing that, you know, the minute I began to take a serious look at it, you know, if you look at Williamson, if you look at George Van Tassel, if you look at Carl Hunrath, if you look at most of these characters, you know, they're all sort of veterans of the aerospace industry, the connections to intelligence and security agencies, and that's not accidental. All right?
No, no.
You know, in the case of Williamson, I don't think it's accidental that he leaves his little cult of followers off to Peru in the Andes Mountains to form a monastery to communicate with the space people and, I don't know, the Lemurians,
yes.
or whatever he was claiming he was doing. And the place that he eventually picks to set up his little monastery is right next door, and I mean right next door, to a research project funded by the CIA.
Oh, wow.
He sets himself up right next to the main CIA base in the Andes region in the late 1950s. Now, is that an accident? Or is that exactly... But, you know, and I can't tell you exactly what it means. I don't know, you know. The question is, to what degree is this person... Are they a dupe? Or are they a willing participant? That's the other thing.
That's what I love about you, your research, everything that you put forth, Doctor, is the fact that it's just, here's the fact. Make of it what you will, here's the fact.
All right. Here it is. What does that mean?
Yeah.
And when I put that together with other things through his career, his associates, the people he was mixed with, what I see very clearly, and I could be wrong, but I don't think I am, is someone who for most of his adult life was an intelligent asset of someone's.
Yeah.
And who was probably largely involved in manufacturing disinformation for one purpose or another. And but there may be more to it than that, but there are just, and there are a lot of things that sort of go into that. It's not just that one thing; it's the other ones, and you know, it eventually,
wow.
eventually, the coincidences coalesce into a pattern.
Well, and that's what's interesting is that for somebody who for 30 years has taught on the topic of espionage, spies, like you were saying, strange deaths in strange ways, to move into that realm of influence, that realm of research, must have been a head over heels moment for you when that really came to light and came to be for you.
Well, you know, a fair amount of it was stuff that was fairly familiar. I mean, you know, once I began to bump into things that, sort of into familiar things that smacked of the intelligence realm, then
sure.
I was sort of at home, okay? Then it really wasn't alien at all. Now, I could be, you know, one could be accused that, well, I'm fitting things into a pattern that I'm familiar with. So, since I'm inclined to... since I definitely believe in spies, there's no problem about that.
Unfortunately, we know aliens well.
That I will always sort of veer toward, you know, I'll veer towards what's familiar to me, and I'll see that maybe to the exclusion of something else.
Sure.
You know, and that's a fair criticism. That could well be. But I can only sort of approach it from the kind of background that I have. But, I mean, frankly, I think the whole UFO business, among other things, could use more of that, right, as opposed to a kind of unquestioning religious belief in things that you don't actually have any evidence for.
Sure.
But, okay.
Well, especially, a lot of things. Especially yeah. whenever you're talking about cases like that with, and I assume that you're really talking about the whole Dulce Mountain complex.
Yeah, yeah.
Things like that where, you know, what was it the fact that maybe he was a part of an MK Ultra type program? Absolutely. That is something that we know our government is definitely a part of, definitely done in the past, and definitely done in the very recent past. And that there is, it's really interesting because, we're tied in very closely, Dudes and Beer, with the targeted individual community, Doctor. And to know what some of those people go through, where it's regular harassment, regular things that are done to them. It's strange coincidences, that really tend to pop up. Where you start talking about very similar things with people that, like you're saying, deal with that from the government on the side of the good gentleman you were mentioning.
Yeah, well, no, they do mess with us. And to the mystery here isn't, to me, the question isn't whether or not, let's say, agencies mess with people. It's why.
Yeah.
Right. There was a case of, if I go back to the early period, if I look at something sort of like beginning with the whole, you know, Roswell and the rest of it, through 47 up through the early 50s when these flying saucer things are coming along, my conclusion from looking at the government is that in that period, I don't think anybody in the government knows what the hell's going on.
Yeah.
I think they're as mystified about it as everybody else. I don't think it's something that they're doing. Again, I could be wrong. That's my impression. But they can't admit that they don't know what's going on. All right? I mean, this is the one thing that the Air Force could, or anybody else, could never come out and say, which is that, yeah, there are these strange craft that are continually penetrating our airspace and flying around our most secure military areas, but we don't know what they are. We don't have a clue. No.
Yeah, they're so massive. They're huge.
Right. You have to have some kind of a story, or you have to deny they're there at all. And they seem to have done that simultaneously. They seem to have sort of publicly denied there's nothing to this, it's swamp gas. And on the other hand, they're running around, you know, whispering to Benowitz's ear, others, there's a whole bunch of them, they're going to take over the world. All right? Yeah, they're real. And you get this out of, you know, sometimes the same people will deny it, and then they'll come along and swear that it's true. I mean, the only thing that I can see at Roswell is that there was a bunch of debris found in this guy's ranch that had been there for a while, and the Air Force picks it up and then releases a press release that says, oh, we found a flying disc. Not a crashed one, by the way, but a flying disc.
Yeah.
And then the next day they go, oh, no, it was a weather balloon. They found something out there. I don't know what the hell it was, but I do think it's interesting that not too far away at White Sands, they were testing captured V-2 rockets.
Yeah.
So when you look eventually at the number of things that are, like, flying around over New Mexico in 1947, well, it could have been all kinds of things, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And, there you go.
Well, and that's just it. To have somebody like you coming in, who is dispassionate on the topic. I often preach the fact that we too frequently are carried away by our passions and our wants and our preconceptions. We need to be ready to be skeptical. We need to be ready to step back and go, what if it isn't? And 90% of the time to be ready to accept it isn't.
It isn't. You know, that you need to know that, you know, accept the fact that there are things that you would really like to be true.
Yeah.
All right.
And well, that's it'd be sexy as hell.
I would kind of like that to be true, and because I know I like it to be true, I got to be careful about just going in that direction.
That's right.
You got to be... What I generally like to do in terms of research, you know, and I can't deny that in some cases I'd really like something to be true or untrue, but you got to try to keep yourself honest and say, okay, let's just collect the fact that the details that we have, and let's put them together, and let's see what story they tell us. Let's not tell ourselves a story. Let's not believe implicitly the story anybody else has told us.
Yeah.
Let's put aside everybody else's explanation, and let's just look at what's there. All right? And you can sometimes, and in many ways, if you can do that, it's sometimes surprising. Well, sometimes you're just looking at a vacuum, you know, at a void. But in other cases, you can see things that, you know, are pretty obvious, but yeah. Just somehow have been sort of left in the shuffle. I mean, it's so there we go.
Well, once again, thank you so much for coming on the show, talking about this kind of stuff. Oh, absolutely. Anytime. We'd love to have you on once again regularly to talk about this kind of stuff, especially coming up to the election, talking about things like Operation Mockingbird, that kind of stuff, to talk about the fact of there's nary an election around that we don't tinker with in some way. So,
well, think of it this way. Would you actually let people vote for things that are wrong?
Yeah.
The whole political system that we have with indirect representation in a House of Representatives and a Senate and a, you know, Supreme Court to keep somebody from doing something crazy is all really based around the idea, fundamentally, of preventing the masses from making decisions about things. Okay. This whole business that, you know, democracy is about the masses doing things, it's all meant to prevent that.
Yep.
And to keep decision-making among a certain group of people with checks and balances between those particular groups, but just never letting the, you know, the unwashed masses just make generalized decisions for themselves. That would be, well, that's anarchy.
That's disastrous.
You're right. Okay.
That's horrible.
we can't possibly allow that to happen.
And oh my God, there is a reason why greater than 50% of our listenership is in the greater D.C. Virginia area.
In Herndon? How many from Herndon?
Yeah. I'll look at the numbers. Once again, Doctor, thank you so much. Make sure to check out all the great work of Richard B. Spence, everybody. You can go by, find his books on the Dudes and Beer store. You can find them all on Amazon. It is shameless self-promotion time, Doc. Let everybody know where they can find you, where they can get a hold of the great courses, series, secret societies, all that good stuff.
Well, you know, it's pretty easy. You just go and Google the great courses, and they have a huge array of things. I mean, everything from, you know, like golf to indoor gardening. I mean, anything you could possibly ever want to learn about, they've got a course on. And if you're interested in the real history of secret societies, as opposed, I guess, to the fake history of secret societies.
Or the supposed history of secret societies.
Or the supposed history of secret societies, but... by all means, take a look, and it comes in a variety of formats, and, you know, I get my book on Crowley, on Aleister Crowley, and Secret Agent 666, Secret World of Sidney Riley, which is sort of an exploration of early 20th century spies and international skullduggery that I still continue to dig in, and my latest book, which is Wall Street and the Russian Revolution, 1905 to 1925, financial skullduggery, revolutionaries and capitalists getting along, having a tea party. That's what it seems like.
I can't imagine.
That would be an interesting. And the other thing, you know, I just threw out there, I've mentioned this stuff on George Hunt Williamson and the sort of evolution of the whole sort of, you know, UFO phenomenon as some sort of psychological warfare or whatever.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that I am thinking about doing a book on, but it's also one of those things that I'm kind of leery about doing it because, I don't know.
Yeah.
Basically because of the, how shall I put this, the shit I could take for doing, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, is it a place I really want to? So if it's one of those things, anybody out there, if it sounds interesting to you, let me know. If it's one of those things you think I should go find something else to do, then tell me that way. But I could use, anybody who writes and researches on stuff, it doesn't hurt to have a little bit of encouragement every now and then.
That's right.
Just to know, is there someone else out there who thinks this interesting, or is it just me?
Well, again, not just that, but it really is that creative pushback that's necessary sometimes to find out whether or not a topic is even worth exploring and putting your time into on that level. Yeah. So,
because, you know, there are only so much time to research so many things, and there's other stuff. You know, I got a whole book about American spies in revolutionary Russia that's been sitting around for years, pushed aside by one topic after another. So I could go back to that, but I don't know. Williamson is just so creepy and interesting. I have a hard time giving him up.
Well, hold the line and hold that thought while we close the show out, Doc, because I'll chat with you off air real quick.
Okay.
While you're online checking out everything by Richard B. Spence. It's all available there in the Dudes and Beer store, everybody. You can also go to Amazon and check it out. I'm a huge Amazon user. Dudes and Beer is also brought to you by Amazon, believe it or not. Amazon Audible, stop on by. Dudes and Beer is the code that you want to use. You'll get 30 free days. Check it out. And you can even check out Secrets, the Real History of Secret Societies, hosted by Richard B. Spence, one of the greatest 13 hours. I've watched it twice now, folks. So technically 26 in my life. Just really, really revelatory, really raw. Be ready to process some information and be ready to take some information dispassionately and to get rid of some things that you may have that are preconceived notions about topics, because that's what it's about. Until next time, everybody, make sure to stop on by Dudes and Beer. That's where you can find all the episodes. That's where you can find the Knowledge Vault, all the good stuff like the declassified documents for family jewels from the CIA, as well as Operation Mockingbird. I've seen a lot of stuff about the hemisphere synth process lately. That's in there as well.
Thanks for listening.
Take care,
to this
everybody.
Episode
if you can't
Dudes
be good,
and Beer
be good
podcast.
At it. We'll talk to you soon.
To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.